All right. It's good to be with you. Good to be in an all-male space. Very fitting. It's a construction space. Very fitting. There's beer and whiskey back there. So I want to talk to you today in as practical a way as possible. So you can think of this as kind of a workshop or a seminar. How many of you are married? Okay, so most of you. I'm going to work through several topics in a pretty rapid-fire way, and if you want to talk about some of these things afterwards, we can do that. I'm calling this Practical Patriarchy, a Playbook for Household Leadership. So it's mainly aimed at married men. But if you're a single man, I think there will be some good things here for you to know. If you want to be married someday, if you want to understand women, who wants to understand women? I will explain all their mysteries and secrets to you today. So first topic that I talked about a little last night is polarity. We talked about sexual polarity a little bit last night. Polarity is the key to attraction. This is the key thing you need to remember. Sexual polarity drives sexual attraction. The masculine is drawn to the feminine, and the feminine is drawn to the masculine. That is biblical truth. That is biological truth. Many marriages today are not polarized enough. That is, they're not sexually differentiated enough. In sexless marriages or in low-sex marriages, one common problem is a lack of polarity. Men, you have been told that your masculinity is toxic. It is not toxic. It is good. There's actually a book called It's Good to Be a Man. Pretty good book if you haven't read it. Michael Foster. He was actually here last time I spoke. Michael and I spoke together. Real masculinity is not toxic. Real masculinity is attractive. Women don't or won't always admit that, but it's true. They find real masculinity attractive. So I would say to a married man, don't be the man your wife has to have sex with. Be the man she wants to have sex with. That's the way to think about it. I've got some things that I want to say about sexual refusal within marriage. Maybe I'll come back and talk about that at the end, because I do think that's an important issue for men to understand. But let me make this point here. Most of what men are taught about attraction, most of what you would pick up about male-female attraction, say from the culture or very often from the church, is simply false. And this is one reason why I think men are so clueless today. Why a lot of young men, but also a lot of married men, they don't understand how to generate sexual attraction if they're pursuing a woman or in a marriage. Washing the dishes might help your wife. It does not arouse your wife. You should help with the dishes at times. That's probably a very good thing to do. But do it as a way to bless her, not because you're trying to buy sexual favors from her. Understand, and this is what I mean when I say sexual polarity drives sexual attraction. What arouses women, what attracts women, are conventional masculine attributes. Things like confidence, competence, courage, having a mission, having a purpose, having ambition. Okay, when you're a masculine man, that is attractive. Your wife will love you for it, and more importantly, she will respect you and even admire you for it. She will be attracted to you for it. She might even call you Lord with a straight face, the way Sarah called Abraham Lord. You must learn to live in your masculine strength. You have to live out your calling as head. You have to live in a way that displays masculine energy. Women are not attracted to men they view as objects of pity. Okay, if she pities you, you will activate her maternal instinct, but that's a very different kind of thing. She's not going to be attracted to you if she feels sorry for you. Okay, so if you make yourself into an object of pity, say through your whining or complaining, she might feel sorry for you. She will not be attracted to you. In fact, probably at some level, she's going to be disgusted by you because that's not what she expects in a man. Let me go one step further. In a lot of marriages, the issue is not just a diminishing of polarity. It is a reversal of polarity. When a man is passive, when a man abdicates, when a man has no vision for his life and for his family, when he provides no leadership, he's not only disobeying God, he's destroying attraction within his marriage. And she's going to pull away because he's pulled away from his masculine calling, she's going to pull away from him. You end up in a situation that can be very hard to fix. Not impossible, but very hard to fix. But here's something that men need to understand. When you, if you find yourself in that situation, we talked about this last night in the Q&A, so you've been going for years and you have not been leading your family the way that you should. What do? How do you fix it? You're not going to fix it by doing what your wife tells you to do. Okay, that's what most men do in that situation. They say, honey, just tell me what to do. Anything you tell me to do, I'll do it. The problem with that approach is that you're still not leading, you're following. You're still emasculated. You're basically asking your wife to lead you into masculinity, to lead you into headship, and that just can't happen. When you lose polarity, or especially when you reverse polarity, it makes you more like roommates than husband and wife. You might still have a functional marriage, things might still be functioning in the home, but you will not have a satisfying marriage, and over time that's going to catch up with you. Masculine leadership draws out a woman's femininity. It draws out her feminine surrender, her loyalty. She becomes softer and more relaxed in the presence of a masculine man. She's more peaceful. She's less anxious. She's less combative. Here's a rule just to take to heart. Wives make terrible husbands. And husbands make terrible wives. You're not interchangeable pieces. It's a dance, and you each have your part. You each have your dance steps. There was a study done over the course of 20 years by a university in Norway. And Norway, of course, is known. All the Scandinavian countries are known for being very egalitarian, basically trying to minimize the differences between the sexes as much as possible. But this 20-year study found that egalitarian marriages, that is, marriages with no male headship and therefore no sexual polarity, have a 50% higher divorce rate compared to those where the man leads. Okay, the cultural narrative would tell you it's the other way around. When a man leads, that's toxic masculinity. That's what's going to implode your marriage. That's the other way around. It's the egalitarian marriages that fail much more often. They also found that those egalitarian marriages have far less sexual satisfaction. And this actually should not be that hard to figure out. Okay, I don't read romance novels. I'm sure you don't read romance novels. I hope your wife doesn't read romance novels. But here's the reality. There are no egalitarian romance novels. Because there's not anything romantic about egalitarianism. Okay, that's not, okay, if you look at what women actually buy and read, there's nothing egalitarian about it. Okay, and that tells you something. You know, when things like 50 Shades of Grey, are super popular, that tells you something about what women are actually attracted to. Even though they often don't want to, or won't say that. It's very easy for men to stop investing in their marriages after they've been married for a while, to stop leading their wives, to stop pursuing their wives, because you feel like you've accomplished what you set out to do, which is to find a wife, and so it's easy to become lax after you've, you know, you sort of check the box. It's easy to grow lax. Men are tempted to focus on their work. Women are tempted to focus on the children when they come along. And what happens if a man is totally investing everything in his work and a woman's investing everything in the children? Very easy for a husband and wife to drift apart. And of course, the marriage begins to crumble from within. So if you're a husband, it's your duty as a husband, as head, to continue cultivating your relationship with your wife, to keep leading the marital dance, as it were. You know, it's a dance with dance steps, the dance steps of headship and submission. It's your duty to continue to cultivate the relationship. A lot of men will succeed at work but fail at home because it's actually much harder to lead at home than it is at work. One thing I would exhort you as husbands to do, those of you who are husbands, don't get lazy, don't slack off, keep pursuing your wife. Okay, that's something you've got to do. Here's another principle. Beware of therapy culture. Okay, so understand attraction. That's one whole package of things, and I might come back and say a little bit more about that at the end. But here's another principle, and this is something I think husbands need to be very aware of. Be aware of therapy culture, because there are many women in the culture, there are many Christian women in the church who get sucked into therapy culture. Okay, and this happens often through social media or through books or through podcasts. It even happens sometimes in our circles. I've seen it happen in CRUC circles. And the reason women are particularly prone to this, particularly vulnerable to this, is because there are certain things about therapy culture that appeal to their worst feminine sensibilities. Okay, one example of this that you probably have heard about is toxic empathy. Now, I'm not going to go on about toxic empathy because it's already gotten extended treatments in books by Joe Rigney and Allie Beth Stuckey, and I would just tell you to read those books. You know, read Rigney's book, read Stuckey's book, maybe even have your wife read them. But let me give you a few other examples of this that may not be as well known. Take the drama queen. Okay, a lot of females become known as drama queens. What is a drama queen? A drama queen is a woman who magnifies her problems in order to get attention. The drama queen has a narcissistic quality. She has to be the star of the show, often sort of the heroine, or as is more often the case, the victim. Drama queens usually have a victim mindset. When a woman is a drama queen, when she has that drama queen mentality, she usually has a victimhood mentality. She's usually a woman who is easily bored and who struggles to find contentment because she's easily bored. She will create the drama. She will create the excitement for herself. She will create that excitement by being dramatic. That's the kind of thing that needs correction. That's the kind of thing that if a man's married to a woman who plays the part of a drama queen, I would say that's something that you need to work on with your wife. Here's another example. What do? When you don't think you have sinned, but your wife says, you hurt my feelings? What do you do if you don't think you've sinned, and she starts crying, and you don't think you've done anything wrong? Okay, one thing that I would say is that if you haven't done it, you know, obviously check yourself, but if you haven't done anything wrong, then you shouldn't produce a fake confession. Okay, some men will do that as a way of trying to keep the peace. They'll even though they don't believe they've sinned, they don't think there's anything to confess, they'll make up a sin and confess it in order to appease their wives. That's not the way to go. The problem a lot of men have is that they are afraid of their wife's emotions. They realize they can't argue with her emotions, and it's pointless to try. Her feelings don't care about your facts. Her emotions cannot be tamed by your logic. Most women's emotions really are like the weather. I mean, not all women are equally emotional or equally emotionally expressive. But for women in general, their emotions are kind of like the weather. They fluctuate wildly. They're never constant. When you're married to a woman who's going to have her emotional ups and downs, her emotional storms, you need to see her emotions as a test of your leadership. They are a test of your ability to lead your wife. Her emotional reactions are a test you need to pass. There's that famous line by Marilyn Monroe where she says, if you can't handle me at my worst, you don't deserve me at my best. Okay. Well, to put it bluntly, you need to know how to handle your wife. You need to know how to handle her at her worst, even. If her emotions are chaotic, and oftentimes this is the case, a woman's emotions seem chaotic to a man, it is your job to bring order out of the chaos. I think I talked about this when I was here a few years ago, Psalm 128. Psalm 128 describes the blessed family, and it's this beautiful picture of family life, and it starts off with the blessed man. It starts off, blessed is the man who fears God. And then it goes on to describe him seated around the table with his children, and his wife is in the heart of his home, and she's this beautiful flowering vine, and his children are like olive vines. It's a beautiful picture of what family life should look like. Blessed is the man who fears God. That's how it starts. Not blessed is the man who fears his wife, but blessed is the man who fears his God. Fear of God leads to wisdom. Fear of wife leads to foolishness. And especially for young husbands, this can be difficult because you have to learn, you have to master the art of being gentle with her while also being firm. A man who is more wife-fearing than God-fearing, a man who is a wife-pleaser more than a God-pleaser, is going to struggle with this. If he lives by that demonic slogan, happy wife, happy life, he's going to find it very difficult to not just give in every time she gets emotional because he doesn't know how to handle her emotions. Or he might find himself getting emotional, which makes things even worse. He kind of gets sucked into the vortex of her emotion. He gets emotional herself. Now, I would also say, you know, if a wife is having one of these episodes, I'd also say that a man should not say to her, why don't you just calm down? Okay, that doesn't work either. Or telling her, you know, you're actually sounding a lot like your mother right now. That doesn't really work either. But you can't appease her either, because that's a great way to turn your wife into an emotional terrorist. Okay? Emotional outbursts should not be rewarded. And if you are constantly trying to appease your wife every time she gets emotional, and you might do this because you're too conflict avoidant, or because you value being liked more than you value being respected, or you value your wife's approval more than you value God's approval, you're going to have a very hard time leading your wife in the direction she needs to go. What your wife needs from you in those difficult, highly emotional moments is your calmness, your poise, your conviction, your patience, your wisdom. In a word, what she needs from you in those moments is your masculine strength. She's the storm, you're the rock. She's the hurricane, you're the lighthouse. Be kind to her in those moments, but do not allow yourself to be manipulated. Give her reassurance. I love you, honey. It's going to be okay. And also give her direction. This is what we're going to do. Assurance, reassurance, and direction. A wife's respect for her husband will grow over time when she sees that he can love her and lead her when she's at her worst. That's what she needs to know. In those moments, don't be too defensive. Don't get swept up into the vortex of her emotions by becoming overly emotional yourself. Don't get offended. Don't get anxious. Reassure her, love her, direct her. Again, be the rock when she has her emotional storms. Show her you are a man worthy of her trust in those moments. She might be feeling overwhelmed with the kids. It's just more work than she can handle. She might be feeling overwhelmed with the bills. How are we going to make ends meet? She'll be overwhelmed with something. That's where you have to step in and love her and lead her. You have to reassure her and you have to direct her. And remember this too. This is another point, and I think I alluded to this last night, but I want to reiterate it here. Remember, all leadership starts with self-leadership. To lead your wife, you have to lead yourself. If you can't lead yourself, you're in no position to lead others. You can't bring order to your family if your own life is in chaos. You have to order your own life first, then you can bring order to others. You can't be a buffer absorbing her emotional energy if your own emotions still need sorting out. You got to get your own self, your own emotions sorted out first. You have to live a disciplined, ordered, stable, consistent life yourself in order to bring those blessings to your family. And that brings me to my next point. Suppose your marriage is a struggle. You know, many men will find themselves in this kind of situation. Marriage is a struggle. It's hard. It's difficult. It is not a happy marriage. You know you shouldn't get divorced. That's not an option. That's off the table, but it's just a difficult marriage. There's a lot of arguing. There's a lot of fighting. There's a lot of frustration. What do you do in that situation? Well, a lot of people today would say, you're having struggles as a couple. You should go to couples counseling. Okay, counseling is presented as a catch-all answer for almost every problem we face in the modern world. I mean, it's like everybody and their brother's got a therapist today. Okay, I mean, when I was growing up in the, you know, the 80s, I mean, I didn't know anybody who had a therapist. And if we had heard of that, we would have mocked him mercilessly. Okay, but now it's just so common. We all should have been therapists. You know, no telling how much money is being made. Some people would say, okay, you're struggling. We'll go to couples counseling. Okay, maybe. But I'm very concerned about counseling, about the counseling industry, especially when it comes to marriage, for at least two reasons. I could give more, but I'll give you two. First, most counselors, even most Christian counselors outside of the church, are heavily tainted by feminism. That's just a fact. You think about the kind of person, male or female, who goes into counseling, and then you think about the kind of books that are read and studies that are produced and so forth. There's just no question the counseling industry is heavily tainted by feminism, and that includes Christians, Christian counseling ministries. Most Christian counselors have been heavily influenced by egalitarianism and by feminism, and so they do not honor a husband's headship. And so what happens when a couple comes in for a counseling session? The counseling session quickly turns into a struggle session for the husband. And if she starts crying, then he's really dead meat. Okay, that's just the way it goes. The counselor is almost certainly going to take her side, and just by default, and blame him. I've been in pastoral ministry for over 30 years. I've seen this happen again and again and again. There's a rare exception, but that's usually what happens. Now, in a church like yours, what I would say to do, if you need help, if your marriage is struggling, I would say, go to your pastor. And only get counseling outside of the church if your pastor recommends it and approves of the counselor you're going to. But here's another problem with couples counseling. And that this is inherent just structurally in it. It tends to outsource leadership of the marriage to the counselor. And so what happens when a husband and wife come in and sit down for counseling? Now it's not a husband leading his wife. And a wife submitting to her husband. It's not that anymore. No, now it's both of them submitting to the counselor. Now, if counseling is taking place inside the church and the counselor is a pastor, I think that can work because all church members, men and women, are called to submit to their elders, including their pastor. So there is an authority structure there that's in place. I think that can work. But once you go outside the church, it gets a whole lot messier. Because it blurs the lines of authority and submission. Who is the head? When this couple goes in for couples counseling, who's the head of the family at that point? Is it the husband or is it the counselor? Has the counselor become the de facto head of this marriage, now telling both of them what to do? This is what I would say. This is the approach a man should take if his marriage is struggling. This should be your plan. Recognize first that you cannot fix your marriage. You cannot make your wife submit to you. You cannot make her do the right thing. You cannot control her. You cannot make her obey you or obey God. You cannot fix her. But you can fix yourself. And so do that. You can't control her, but you can control yourself. And perhaps by repenting of your own failings, seeking to lead her well, by growing in self-control and maturity yourself and growing in wisdom yourself, you can influence your wife to do her part and follow your example. Wives have an influence with their husband. I talked about that some last night from 1 Peter chapter 3. Wives have ways they can influence their husbands with their feminine power. But husbands have even greater influence with their wives. That's the good news. Here's another point, another thing to think about. One thing that I think often helps in marriages that are very difficult, where it's just a real struggle, one thing that I think can really help is to recover playfulness. This is something that, if you've read Edwin Friedman's book, Failure of Nerve, this is something he talks about. I think it's very helpful. Recovering playfulness. Sometimes when things get, when there start to be problems in a marriage, things get too tense. They get almost too serious. And what the marriage needs more than anything is just a heavy dose of playfulness. And so as a man, you need to learn to smile in the face of adversity. Rather than panic, you've got to learn to laugh in the face of adversity. Humor. And being funny. Particularly being funny in ways that don't degrade. You don't want your wife to be the butt of your jokes. That's not going to help. But if you can bring some humor to the situation, if you can do fun things together, what happens? It diffuses the tension and anxiety in a marriage. In fact, humor is something that women find incredibly attractive in men. And humor is a form of flirting with your wife. Women like to laugh. They like to laugh when men are funny. Humor is attractive. I've said many times that most husbands could solve the bulk of their marriage problems if they could just make their wives laugh at least once a day. Laughter's medicine, and it's medicine in all kinds of ways. It's medicine for a troubled marriage, a sick marriage. What happens when you as a man can be funny? It shows you're relaxed. It shows you're not anxious. It shows you're not just being reactive. Playfulness is often more effective than seriousness when a relationship is in trouble. It breaks gridlock. Again, this is a point that Friedman makes. Instead of going to a counselor, maybe buy a book of jokes. It's cheaper. It's cheaper. Okay, here's another point. Another thing I would say is that if a husband has not been, I talked about this a little bit last night in the Q&A, but I want to reiterate it here. If a husband has not been leading well or leading at all, where does he begin? How does he start to get himself and his family back on the right track? I would tell that husband to start with something small and something that should be non-controversial. If your marriage has problems, again, you can't try to fix everything at once. So the example I used last night was to start doing family worship. And if she tests you with some pushback, which is very likely if you've not been leading for a long time, you have to gently push through her pushback. You have to pass her test. or start to take charge of all the child discipline when you're at home. I mean, that's something that a man should be doing. When he's at home, if it's at all possible, he should be the one who's handling the child discipline. Your wife probably won't argue with that if you start to do that. That's a place where you can start to exert leadership. Now, she might criticize the way you do it, but you can't let that deter you. Okay, you might have to deal with those criticisms, but you should not let them deter you. When you start to lead, after you haven't been leading for a long time, you should expect sabotage. That's the first thing that's going to happen. And so be prepared for it, and then push through it. If you've got a backlog of unconfessed sin, what do? Confess it. Seek forgiveness. You know, again, as I said last night, confession of sin is to your marriage what spring cleaning is to your house. It sort of presses the reset button. It's like wiping the slate clean so you can start over. I would tell you to go read what Doug Wilson has to say about keeping short accounts. Don't make excuses. Take responsibility. Name your sin. Seek forgiveness. If you failed your wife in various ways by not leading, confess that to her. Seek her forgiveness. Confess it to God. Seek God's forgiveness. You know, if you go years without cleaning up your garage, it finally gets so bad that you just want to ignore it. But no problem goes away by being ignored. You know, after a while, again, like I said last night, you start to think, well, it'd just be easier to burn the whole house down. Okay, don't do that. Instead, just get to work. I mean, even if it's a really big mess, get to work. Right as many wrongs as possible. Right as many wrongs as you can. I have seen, again, in decades now of pastoral ministry, I have seen God resurrect dead marriages this way. Even in a situation where the wife did not seem particularly interested in the marriage being resurrected, the husband starts to work on himself, and sooner or later his wife catches on. He starts to work on himself, make himself a better man, he starts doing the things he should have been doing all along, and next thing you know, she's working on herself too. Doesn't always happen that way. It doesn't always have the happy ending, but very often it does. Here's another principle for marriage. Learn how to fight fair. Don't think of marriage as a zero-sum game where there must be a winner and a loser in every argument or difference of opinion. Think of marriage as a team where you win or lose together. This is one of the most important things, I think, for young married couples to learn. Learn to triangulate your problems. It's not you versus your wife. Rather, it's you and your wife together as a team figuring out how to solve that problem over there. And then you attack the problem together rather than attacking each other. That's how you have to learn to think about differences within your marriage. Most of the time when a marriage blows apart, it is not because of the presenting issue. The presenting issue is just the most current manifestation of a deep and underlying pattern of failing to deal with things, of failing to resolve problems as they arise over time. And so what's happened over time, because so many problems have not been dealt with, resentment and bitterness build up until finally the dam breaks and you're flooded. Men were not made to fight with women. They were made to fight for women. And so you should avoid fights or arguments with your wife as much as possible. And one way you can do that is by staying one step ahead of things and anticipating what is to come. Again, another way you can do it is by being quick to confess and repent when you have failed in some kind of way. But if you will consistently demonstrate tangible leadership, giving her protection, giving her security, recognizing her fears and address them as they arise, being present with her, you can cut a lot of these things off at the pass. Here's another issue. What do you do if your wife is openly disrespectful? If she talks to you like you're one of the kids, or she speaks disrespectfully to you in front of the kids? Well, face the fact that it's probably your abdication that produced this. You have most likely taught your wife to treat you this way. You have taught her to disrespect you by failing to lead her well. And your silence in the face of her disrespect teaches her that you're not a man worthy of respect. You haven't set boundaries. You haven't enforced standards. Here's something you need to understand about women. Women generally take the shape of the container they're poured into. Okay, which is to say, most men, not all, there are exceptions to this, but most men get the marriage they deserve. Most men get the wife they deserve over time. And a lot of this is what he allows her to get away with. You get more of what you tolerate. So if you just absorb her disrespect with silence, or you try to laugh it off like, oh, it's really no big deal, even make excuses for her behavior, what's going to happen? You're going to get more of that behavior. You need to see it as a test. Just like as a parent, when your children disobey you, you really shouldn't take it personally. You just have to recognize that by disciplining them, you're doing what's best for them because they need to learn how to submit to your authority. Okay, in the same kind of way, you don't have to take it personally. You just have to recognize it is bad for your wife and it is bad for your family, for you as the head of the home, to be disrespected. That is going to produce all kinds of disorder and chaos and confusion in your home if not dealt with. If you become your wife's emotional tampon, you're going to get treated like a tampon. Okay, that's just a reality. You are not her girlfriend. You are her husband. And you will not fix disrespect by sharing your feelings or by complaining about it or by seeking her validation. You have to become a man she can lean on. You have to become a man that she recognizes this man has standards. This man has certain things he will not tolerate. Again, many men are afraid to stand up to their wives, but this is what you must learn to do. And again, you have to learn to do it in the right kind of way, but you have to do it. And if you don't do it, she will rightly see you as weak. And you need to understand, women despise weakness in men. In fact, I think most women would prefer a jerk to a weak man. They'd rather be with a jerk than a weak man. Now, that, thankfully, those are not the only two choices. Those are not the only two options. You can be a strong man who's a good man. That's what you want. But you have to understand, women despise weakness in men. And so when you don't stand up to that disrespect, you just get more of it because you're showing you're not really worthy of respect. You can set boundaries without being harsh. You can set boundaries without being a jerk. But understand, you're never going to gain her respect by withdrawing or by giving her the silent treatment. That's what some men will do. Is I'm going to give my wife the silent treatment. I'll show her. That's not going to help. Or you're not going to solve this problem by just staying out of the way, kind of making yourself scarce. You've got to explain to your wife your boundaries. You've got to explain to her what respect means, what it means for her to respect you. If you leave a void of leadership in your marriage, she's going to fill it. Okay, and that's one of the ways that women masculinize themselves. There's a void of leadership here. She feels like she's got to step in and fill it, and so she does that. Okay, but that does not help. Okay, you're not going to fulfill God's design for marriage that way. You can't leave that void of leadership. The more passive you are, the more reactive she will be. That's, again, just a fact. The more passive you are, the more reactive she will be. She will try to fill the void you are leaving with her emotion, and that's going to create, again, all kinds of drama and anxiety, and it's going to make the whole household a toxic place. Here's another issue. Often wives will take on too much. And they will stress themselves out. Sometimes she needs you to step up and say, hey, we're not going to do X, Y, and Z. Instead, we're going to do A, B, and C. Or maybe we're not going to do X, Y, and Z, and we're not going to do A and B either. We're only going to do C. Sometimes she needs you to step up and provide boundaries for her. You've got to provide boundaries for yourself. You've also sometimes got to provide boundaries for your wife. You've got to provide structure and priorities and direction. One of the best ways a husband can love his wife is by saying no for her. No, I'm not going to let you take that on. And so she knows you're putting up a shield to protect her from responsibilities that would just overwhelm her. And when she sees you doing that regularly, then she can start to relax. Okay, you're setting boundaries for her, and she can thrive within those boundaries. You relieve some of the pressure she puts on herself. Women actually are very often very hard on themselves. Women can put a lot of pressure on themselves. One of the best ways you can love your wife as a husband is to protect her from herself. This is especially true, say during holiday seasons when wives and mothers can easily overburden themselves and try to take on too much. Your strength, your leadership is what allows your wife to relax and lean into you. And that's when you get the feminine softness that you enjoy being around. Be the man so she can be the woman. Your tone, your affection, your self-control, your organization, your consistency, your wisdom, all can help her help you. But if you crumble the first time she pushes back a little bit, the first time she gets a little bit emotional, none of it's going to work. Some men are overly agreeable because they're so afraid of confrontation. Some men are overly agreeable because they simply lack conviction, and so they drift. And that's when bad things start to happen. Many women are not, so many wives who struggle and who maybe seem disrespectful to their husbands, they're not actually rebellious, they're just underled. They're underled. Their husbands aren't providing enough leadership. They're not getting very much concrete direction from their husbands. And so what do you expect to happen? It's like not giving rules to your kids, and your kids start to just kind of do whatever because they don't know. I'm not saying that your wife is like a child, but I'm just saying there's an analogy here in terms of the way authority is used. A lot of wives are not so much rebellious as it is they are underled. You need to be clear when you communicate with your wife. Don't just offer suggestions. Actually make decisions. Be decisive. Tell her definitively, this is what we're going to do. We're not going to do that. We're going to do this. Instead of just, hey, why don't we? Or have you thought about? Because that still sort of puts the burden of leadership on her. Don't leave your wife in a marriage with a masculinity deficit. Don't over-explain yourself. Okay, you should be clear, direct, but some men go on and on like it's a court case and they're trying to justify themselves, and that's not helpful either. That doesn't inspire confidence. A lot of this is a matter of habit, routine, discipline, order. You should aim at creating rhythms and order in your household so your wife and your kids know what to expect. And when you're bringing that kind of order, your wife and your children can thrive. When you say, this is going to be our bedtime for the kids and we're going to stick to it. This is going to be our morning routine and we're going to stick to it. That kind of order is very helpful. Imagine a football coach who doesn't organize practice time. Who doesn't organize any drills, a coach with no plan or vision or agenda. He just says, all right, guys, here's a football. Go out there and get better at it. Okay, that's not going to help. Okay, but that's what a lot of husbands do with their families. Okay, and you got to understand, you're sabotaging your marriage. You're sabotaging your family life if that's the approach you take. A lot of husbands are like boys with a mortgage. Okay, they're not really men. They're not really grown up. They're not really taking on the responsibility or exerting the authority that comes with their office. Your wife does not need you to be perfect. She does need you to be present and consistent. Okay? Virtually every man, certainly every Christian man, wants his wife to be happy. Okay? You want to have a happy wife. Life is much better when your wife is happy. And you want your home to be a happy place. You want your home to feel warm. When you walk in from a hard day's work and you walk through the door, you don't want to feel like you're walking into a freezer. Okay? You want it to be a warm place, not a cold place. So you have to take ownership, and you have to take ownership of where things are right now. You can't blame shift. You can't be like Adam in the garden. God, it's this woman you gave me. You gave me a defective wife. Okay, it's your fault, really. Okay, no, you have to step up. You have to pay attention to what's going on in your home. You have to observe what's actually happening in your home, and then you have to set direction. So when your wife's having a bad day, for example, don't change your whole routine just to accommodate her. Don't say, well, mom's having a bad day, so we're going to cancel family dinner or cancel family worship. Push through those bad days. Maintain the order. Maintain the discipline. Lead her with masculine love. Don't let her emotions knock you off course. Keep pursuing your mission. Okay, here's another one. I think this is a really important one. How long should I go? How long do we have?
Keep going.
Okay. All right. I'll keep going. You guys tell me when to stop. Here's another one. Bear burdens more than you impose burdens, okay? Be careful. This is going to sound strange for some of you, perhaps, but I'm right. So be careful about being overly vulnerable with your wife. Be careful of being overly vulnerable. Yes, you can share struggles you have at work or struggles you have in your life, say in the context of prayer. So it's something that you can pray about together as a couple. But be very careful about oversharing. Be very careful about being overly vulnerable. Be very careful about anything that might come across as whining or complaining or grumbling. You should be vulnerable before God. There are lots of struggles that you might share with your band of brothers, your male friends, in a certain kind of way, that you would not share with your wife. Because your job as her husband is not to put burdens on her, but to bear burdens for her. And if you are overly vulnerable with your wife, It will appear to her that you are seeking her pity. And again, you will activate her maternal instinct. And women are never attracted to men they pity. She might feel sorry for you. She will not be aroused by you. You want a wife, not a mother. Okay? That's how you, that, you want to keep that, that wife, that husband-wife relationship there. Don't expect your wife to shield you from stress. You're supposed to do that for her. Again, don't reverse polarity. Okay, here's a key point. Women respond to masculine strength the same way men respond to feminine beauty. Okay? What happens when a really beautiful girl walks in the door? Okay? All the men's heads snap. Okay? And then if we're Christian men, we snap back. Okay? But we did notice it. Okay? We did notice it. Okay? That response you had, you know, that beauty, there's a glory in that. Okay? There's something about that that inspires you as a man. Okay? That is what masculine strength does for a woman. It creates that same feeling, that same response. It inspires her in the same kind of way. Okay? I mentioned this a little bit last night, but let me say a little bit more about it here. Your wife's anxiety traces all the way back to Genesis 3. Her anxiety about you as a husband traces all the way back to Genesis chapter 3 when Adam let Eve down. Okay? It's like women have this deep, primal memory of what Adam did, and it's just passed along from one generation of women to the next, deeply imprinted upon their psyche. And so every wife wonders deep down, will he betray me? And will he fail to protect me as Adam did? Or will he take care of me? Okay? Every woman is wondering this in the depths of her heart. Will he betray me and fail to protect me like Adam? Or will he take care of me and protect me like Adam should have? Is my husband more like the first Adam or the second Adam? Can I trust him to be the kind of man I need him to be? Can he be strong when I am weak? Okay, those are the questions that are on the heart of every wife. Women can certainly respond to those questions in destructive ways by complaining or controlling or nagging or manipulating. You know, those would be her typical sin patterns that the Bible identifies in those situations. Okay, she's got her own responsibility before God for how she deals with those questions. But here's the thing. Given the propensity of wives to be anxious and fearful and insecure, what wives need most from their husbands is their strength, their security. Okay, in 1 Peter 3, Peter calls the wife the weaker vessel. Okay. If she is the weaker vessel, men complement that by being the stronger vessel. A lot of marriages struggle because they have no stronger vessel. A marriage with two weaker vessels is a marriage without polarity. It's a marriage without leadership. A marriage with no stronger vessel is a weak marriage. Okay. Your wife has enough vulnerabilities on her own. She doesn't need all of yours piled on top of hers. Okay. How is she the weaker vessel? She's weaker physically, she's weaker psychologically, she's weaker structurally in terms of her role in the marriage and in the family. Her role includes childbearing and child nurturing, which makes her uniquely vulnerable, at least for a season of life. Her calling to submit to you, to obey you, makes her vulnerable to your tyranny. Okay, so she is the weaker vessel in all kinds of ways. Okay, I mean, physically is the most obvious, but that's not the only way she's the weaker vessel. Part of your job description as her husband is to live with her in understanding. That's what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 3. And part of living with her in an understanding way is relieving her anxieties through your masculine strength. Okay, that does not negate her need to cast her cares upon God in prayer. But one of the ways God answers her prayer is through your masculine strength. Through knowing she has a husband who is stable, reliable, dependable. Your job as a husband is to relieve her anxieties, not to compound them. Okay? This is why women are typically drawn to men who are competent, confident, ambitious, physically strong. Those are the classic masculine virtues, the classic masculine traits. And the reason she's drawn to them is because all of them are anxiety reducers for her. She has a lot of anxiety. She looks for a man who can reduce her anxiety. That's a strong man. That's a man who's capable in all these ways. A man who never grows up, a man who never takes on responsibility, a man who is weak, who does not exert himself as a leader. All that's going to do is compound her baseline fears, her baseline anxieties about the world. A woman wants a man who is going to be strong enough under God to provide and protect for her and the kids, thus relieving a great deal of her anxiety. Okay, those are the qualities and patterns that inspire her confidence and her respect as opposed to her doubt and her fear. And here's another thing that I would put in with that. I would say, men, be very careful about self-deprecation. Okay, in general, you should not practice self-deprecation. Some men will do this because they think it sounds humble, you know, to say, oh, I married up, you know, I really outkicked my coverage, you know, when I married, you know, when I got her to marry me, you know, she's my better half, all these kinds of things. And men are continually cutting themselves down. Okay, what you need to realize is that your wife already has her doubts about you. You don't need to feed them. Okay? She's already wondering if she really made the right choice and if she could have done better. Okay, so don't encourage that line of thinking in her. Okay, that's not going to get you anywhere. Okay, Tom Petty's got a song called, what's it called? You Got Lucky. Okay, make that your theme song. Okay, that's really what it is. It's like, you got lucky when you found me. Okay, I'm not saying that either. I'm not saying you should be arrogant. Okay, but I'm just saying you should not do things that are going to increase your wife's doubts about you. You should work at being a man worth following, a man worth submitting to. Being overly vulnerable with your wife is not a turn on. In fact, it's a turn off. As a man, you are the dominant sex. You are the stronger sex. You need to tap into your masculine strength and cultivate it and exercise it so you can lead her in a good direction. Now, I'm not saying you have to solve all your wife's problems, okay? But, you know, we men do pride ourselves actually being problem solvers. So let's talk about this for just a minute. This is an interesting one, I think, to think about. Many men pride themselves in how they can solve problems, including husbands priding themselves in how they can solve their wife's problems. Maybe you saw the video that went around several years ago. It's not about the nail, okay, where the wife's got the nail sticking out of her head, and he keeps saying, but I think, you've got this nail stuck in your head. I think that's the problem. You know, she's saying things like, I've just got this pounding feeling in my head, and my sweaters are snagged. It's like, I think it's the nail. She's like, it is not about the nail. Okay, he's trying to problem solve, and that's not what she wants in that moment. Okay, that's a funny video because it's so true in terms of how men and women relate. Men often want to rush to solutions when a solution is not what she wants in that moment. What she wants to know in that moment when she's sharing her problems with you, what she wants is not a solution. What she wants is to know that she is cared for. She wants you to enter into the problem with her before you solve it. Now, I don't know why women are this way. But they just are. And the sooner you as a man recognize it, the better your life will be. Okay? Some men just want to be a wife mechanic. You know, they want to get out their ratchet and their screwdriver right away and start problem solving. You know, like, you know, this, I've got a bad spark plug wire on my wife and so I'm going to go fix it. Okay? But she's a woman. She's not a truck. Okay? And she wants a husband, not a mechanic. Okay? Your wife is not a problem to be solved. She is a woman to be loved and led. If you offer solutions right away, she's going to accuse you of not listening. And you'll say, but I am listening. How do you think I could solve your problem without listening? But that's not what she means. Okay. What she wants, again, at least initially, more than your answers, is your presence. Okay. She wants your presence. She wants to have this sense that she matters to you and not just the problem. Okay, that you care about her and not just the problem. She wants to know that she is a woman you love, not a problem you're trying to solve. Okay, when I was first married, I even had people tell me, you know, this about women and I still didn't get it. I just thought, you know, she's got problems, I've got solutions. You know, she's got questions, I've got answers. You know, bring it. Took me a while to figure out that what she wanted from me in those moments was something different. She doesn't need your problem solving so much as she needs your love. Or let me put it this way. She does need your problem solving, but she needs it in a context of compassion and care. Okay? So don't just lecture her with answers when she shares a problem with you. Instead, go on the journey with her. Okay? That's what she really wants. Once she feels heard, she'll be ready for a solution. If she hasn't solved the problem already, just by talking about it out loud. Okay? But at first, what she needs is safety, then solutions. She needs security, then solutions. She needs you to love her, not just show up as Captain Problem Solver. Okay? You want me to stop there and talk, or I can keep going a little bit more if you want.
Yeah, let's talk.
Yeah, okay, let's do it.
I have a question on that last point you made with the nail on the head.
I have an answer.
All right. Solve my problem. So that resonated for sure, like problem solving rather than entering into the problem. My question would be, when you say go on that journey with her, enter into it, and don't try to tell her about the nail on her head, specifically how would one do that? Like what does that look like practically when you're in that moment and she's saying, this is what's going on, this is an issue, this is a problem I have. Maybe it's with you, maybe it's someone else. How do you do what you were just counseling?
Well, at the end of that, it's not about the nail video. You know, the guy finally realizes and she's talking about, you know, her headache or whatever. And he finally just says, oh, that sounds so difficult. Okay, so at that point he's recognized, okay, it's not, there is a nail and we do need to deal with that. But what she really wants is just to know that I care for her, I'm sympathizing with her. So I would just say, let her talk. And have that conversation and express to her how you understand how whatever this is very difficult. Communicate to her, the reality of your care for her. Because that's what she really, now, when you get, and see, this is how men and women, you know, men and women are different, obviously, in all kinds of ways, but this is one of the ways. If your buddy sits down and tells you about a problem he's got, he just wants your solution. Okay, he does not care if you care about him. Okay, all he wants to know is can you tell him why his lawnmower won't start? Okay, he doesn't need you to care for him. He just wants your solution. But with women, it's the opposite. Okay, what they want to know is that you care for them and that you're willing to go on that journey with them. And so you just take that journey. I mean, that's for women, communication. You know, it's kind of like you know, for men, communication is the shortest distance between two points. Okay, for women, it's more like one of those mazes, and it just goes all over, and you do finally get to the destination, okay, but I mean, there's lots of twists and turns along the way, and that's just something that we have to accept about how women are. Good question. Okay, Bill.
So some of the advice you gave us, good advice, would also be pretty good advice for a parent, mm-hmm. a father, dealing
with a lot of the same principles apply.
Or even with a dog owner, dealing with a dog, right? So do you have some thoughts about how we can approach this, you know, what our mindset should be so that we're coming at it as a strong husband rather than a parent or an owner?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. I mean, I would just say that in 1 Peter 3, when Peter says, live with your wife in understanding, I would say that you really do need to be a student of your wife. And obviously there's some things that are fairly universal as a feature of female nature, and you should be able to recognize those things. And there's also going to be things that are very unique and peculiar to your wife, and you need to be a student of those things as well. But a lot of men do not put very much effort into understanding their wives. I think a lot of men just assume that women can't be understood. And so they never really make the effort. You know, women are irrational, so I'm not even going to try. There's a great line by Chesterton where he says that, you know, every man is a beast by the woman's standard, and every woman is sensitive to the point of madness by the masculine standard. But he said it's best for them to find this out about each other while they're in the story of the beauty and the beast. And I think that's exactly right. There are going to be things about your wife that are just plain different, but you have to learn who she is, and you have to work at understanding who she is. And because Peter says live with your wife in understanding, I think we have to say, okay, well that means female nature can be understood. That doesn't mean we're going to understand everything about it. We're men. We don't understand everything about masculine nature. We don't understand everything about ourselves. And in Proverbs, we're told that the way of a man with a maid is a mystery. And it's one of those mysterious things that nobody can fully comprehend. But Peter says we're to live with her in an understanding way. And so men should make themselves students of their wives. So, you know, if you think of it like a school, a lot of men never get past kindergarten or first grade when it comes to understanding their wives. I would say that, you know, at a certain point, like, you should be working on a PhD on your wife because you should understand her so well. That should be your goal, is to progress in your understanding. And some guys would say, well, as soon as I got my wife figured out, she changed. Well, okay, then you figure that out. That's, you know, you continue to work at understanding her. Okay, there's another question back there.
Yeah, two questions. So you talked a lot about what the man should change his behavior. sometimes you feel like you're dragging them along.
Yeah.
Or, because so there's the part of, we're going to do things differently, and now I'm going to explain why we're doing it.
Yeah.
Does that question make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I touched on this a little bit last night, but it's really worth talking about again. When I talked about a man's need for wisdom and to grow in wisdom, you know, part of that is just coming to conviction so you know what you want your family to look like. That's certainly part of it. But I would also say that it takes wisdom to properly explain your convictions to your wife and what you want your family life to look like, and maybe even to persuade her of those things, especially, you know, say she comes from a different kind of family background than you. That may take some work, and it may take some time. So yes, there's leading by example, and that's really important. And if you don't have the example, I'd say anything else you do is not going to really matter very much. But leading by example is not sufficient in and of itself. You also are going to need to do some teaching and instruction and correction and that kind of thing. So yeah, that's absolutely part of it. And so sit down and have those conversations, do Bible study together. And I would say that even as men, sometimes have to correct their wives, men also need to be willing to receive correction from their wives. So one way to think about this is the book of Proverbs. So Proverbs is a father teaching his son. It's the king teaching the prince. And the entire book is structured like a courtship, basically. I mean, we don't think of Proverbs as a story. We think of it as a bunch of random wisdom sayings with a few speeches thrown in. But there really is a kind of progression to it. And so early in the book, the father is teaching his son about the kind of woman to pursue and the kind of woman to avoid. And so you've got these two female archetypes in the book. You've got Lady Wisdom and the Harlot Folly. And obviously the Harlot Folly, she's dressed very seductively. You know, she would fit right in today's society by the way she dresses. And she's loud and boisterous. I mean, you know, she was an early feminist, first wave feminist back in Solomon's day. But what you see with that is that if the young man pursues Lady Wisdom, not only is he going to be a blessing to her, but she will be a great blessing to him. And when you come to the end of the book, what do you have? The wife of noble character. Well, what has happened is he has married Lady Wisdom, and this is her. And this is what their family life looks like since he made the right choice and married the right woman. But if she is his Lady Wisdom, it's interesting that wisdom is depicted mainly in feminine terms in the book of Proverbs. Your wife, the reality is that men and women see the world through different eyes. Okay, just like we speak a different language, you know, men speak, man speak, women speak, feminine speak. We see the world through masculine or feminine eyes. Okay, and it's not that one is better than the other. It's that each is incomplete without the other. And so there are things that your wife will see about the world, about reality, about your children, about relationships and so forth that you will miss. And you need that input from her. And there's going to be, of course, things that you see that she doesn't. And one of the challenges in marriage is learning how to appreciate the perspective that your spouse brings. So as a man, you have to learn, you know, this is the way that I put it for many years. You know, as a man, you don't have a feminine side. God didn't give you a feminine side. He gives you a wife. He gives you a feminine person, okay, to become one with. Okay, so, but you need to learn to appreciate her perspective on the world. And she needs to learn to appreciate your perspective on the world, okay? And then together you get this holistic picture of the world that's bigger and richer than the picture that either one of you would have on your own, okay? So as Lady Wisdom, she is a source of wisdom to you. She should be your closest confidant, your counselor, the one you turn to for advice, okay? To say that the man is head is not to say that the man does all the thinking, okay? It's to say that he is the one who has to make the final decision. He's got the final authority, but he should get, you know, there's wisdom in a multitude of counselors. Well, the first counselor he should turn to is his own wife. That's just how God designed it to work. And so sometimes that's going to be saying, you know what? She saw something I didn't see here. I'm glad she said that because now I see this problem differently and I think we're going to go a different direction than what I would have done and we'll get much better results. Now, if you do what your wife, you know, thinks it's the right thing to do and it turns out to be a disaster, you don't get to blame her because of headship. You know, it's your decision even if it was her idea. Okay? So that I think that's how God designed it to work. But yes, there are going to be times where as the head, the leader of your family, you're going to have to not just set an example before your wife, you're going to have to actually teach her and say, this is why we're doing what we're doing. And one of the best things you can do is insulate your wife from other opinions that might sway her or cause her to doubt. I'm not saying to be controlling or anything like that. I'm just saying women can get a lot of things in their head. And especially now today with social media and all that, it can be very, very difficult to protect what comes into your household, the influences that come into your household. So, and women are, and I talked about this last night too, but women can be very concerned about what other people think. Okay, much more so than men. Men by nature are much more disagreeable than women. You know, that's often why men are better at certain professions than women, and why men often are better at getting raises and that kind of thing, because men are just more confrontational, more direct, more aggressive, less agreeable. Okay, we care less. I'm not saying we don't care at all, and we should care some, but we're not as concerned with what other people think. Okay, your wife's going to be very concerned with what other people think, what her mom thinks and her friends and people at church and people in the neighborhood. And a lot of times the best thing you can do is just insulate her from that and say, you know, we're really not that concerned. I said last night to the ladies, you know, like she needs to be more concerned with what her husband thinks than anybody else. Okay, and I mean, I think that's an important thing to teach her and remind her. But you also sometimes have to block out the other voices that are not going to be helpful for you here. So other questions, thoughts, comments right here?
Yeah, you talk some about oversharing. Is the distinction between a healthy level of sharing and vulnerability versus being whining and grumbling the specifics on what's being shared, kind of like the general volume, or is a lot of it the framing on how it's brought up and the time you're giving to it?
Well, I think it's all of the above. I think the framing and the context all really does matter. Okay, and I'm not saying that you don't share certain things, you know, with your wife just because they might cause anxiety or worry for her. Sometimes you will still need to do that. Okay, but you just have to understand how women work. So, you know, and I've seen this play out. I mean, let's say that you have a bad day at the office and you come home and you complain about your boss. Okay, well, the next day you're over it. You're not thinking about it anymore. 3 weeks later, she's still mad at your boss. Okay, women are multipliers. They are force multipliers, okay? Whatever you bring to her, she's going to multiply, okay? You give her groceries, she multiplies it into a meal, okay? You give her sperm, she multiplies it into children, okay? I mean, you know how this works. I mean, the woman is the glorifier, okay? But she's also the magnifier. So whatever emotion you have that you share with her, multiply it out by three, okay? At least. And that's what your wife is feeling. Okay, so, you know, you were kind of mad at your boss and you said something about it when you got home. And, you know, like on a scale of 1 to 10 emotionally, you were like at a 3. Okay, well, you just shared this with her and now she's at a 12. And not only is she at a 12 today, but she's going to be at a 12. She's still going to be thinking about your boss long after you've forgotten about it. Because that, you know, that's so a lot of it's just understanding that. And a lot of it also is just understanding that again, I'm not saying that women are like children, but think about this. Let's say you were having a hard time paying the bills one month. Like you didn't quite know how ends were going to meet that month. And let's say you got a 5-year-old. Would you go to your 5-year-old and say, hey, you know, I don't know if we can keep the power on this month. I don't know where the money's going to come from you know, to pay these bills. I mean, would you saddle your 5-year-old with those kind of adult worries? I would say no. Like that's like you let the kid be the kid. You don't put burdens on him that he's not designed to bear. You just have to understand your wife is not designed to bear all the burdens that you're called to bear. This is physically true. You've got broader shoulders. Carry bigger burdens. That's what God made you for. And don't put burdens on her that she's not designed to carry. So before you share something difficult with your wife, I think you should ask yourself, you know, is this going to help or hurt? Okay? Is this going to make things, you know, is this going to be good for her to be in on? Or is this going to be the kind of thing that just adds to her anxiety and that crushes her? And so you want to be really, really careful about that. Did you want to add something?
Can you talk specifically about that and answer Michael's question in relationship to sexual sin and purity and all the pornography surrounding us and all those kinds of things?
Yeah.
Confession versus sharing with
absolutely. Yes. So I would say that if you have sin struggles in those areas, you definitely should confess that to your wife because that's a sin against your wife. It's a sin against the marriage. But I would also say you don't want to turn your wife into your accountability partner. Okay, that's what you've got pastors and elders and other men for. Maybe turn your mother-in-law into your accountability partner. That may be the fastest way to solve it. But what happens if you sort of make your wife your accountability partner is you're sort of, you're putting her in charge of you. And you're putting her in a position that she really, like, you shouldn't be putting her in that position. So you need accountability, and you do need to confess sin. And I mean, I don't think a man needs to confess every single lustful thought he might ever have to his wife. But I think that if this is something that has become an issue, like say a porn addiction or something, I would definitely say that's something to confess because that is a sin against her. It's a sin against the marriage. Obviously, you confess it to God as well. And so that's not something that I think you can just keep hidden. But I would also say it's the kind of thing that when it comes to accountability, you should seek that from a pastor or an elder or a brother. You don't want to put your wife in that kind of position. I don't think that's fair to her. It's fine to have occasional check-ins and that kind of thing, but you wouldn't want to put her in that kind of position. So that's what I would say about that. So there's a distinction here between things that you might say are providential trials. Do you share that with your wife versus sins that you have committed? Okay, so, you know, sin should be confessed to God always and sometimes to the person sinned against, if it's interrupting the relationship in any kind of way. Well, obviously, porn use is interrupting your marriage in some kind of way. So that's really important. Garrett?
You want to draw out a little bit, because sometimes men, in regards to this, overshare their lustful thoughts and how women don't fully understand those things.
Yeah. I mean, so men and women do work very different sexually. And it would be wrong to say that women are not visual at all. But they are definitely not visual in the way that men are visual. Okay, that's all it takes is an image for a man to be aroused. It's usually much more than that for a woman. Okay, so male arousal is pretty simple. Female arousal, much more complicated. So that's something that, this is something too you have to deal with, not just with your wife, but of course if you're raising daughters, you eventually have to explain to them as well some things about how men work and why modesty is important, for example. So your wife is not going to ever understand the male sex drive. She's not going to ever understand how men work in that way. But I think that you can help her in ways that are beneficial to your marriage in terms of helping her understand. Let me play something out. I don't know if this is getting right at your question here, but this is the kind of thing that I have thought about and dealt with from time to time. You know, suppose you're a married man and you initiate sex with your wife and she says back to you, that's all you care about. You just want me for my body. That's all you want. Okay, now do a case study. No, analyze that for just a minute. Analyze that interaction. You know, at that point, there are some husbands who neglect their wives and they still expect sex. And I'd say that man is being pretty dumb. He's not living with his wife in an understanding way. He's not doing anything to cultivate attraction, to cultivate her desire for him. And so even if she were to give in at some point because he begs enough or whatever, that's not going to be very satisfying for either one of them. But let's say the husband has done a pretty good job of spending time with his wife, communicating with her, caring for her, and she still is putting him off. Oh, that's all you care about. You just care about one thing. Okay. He could say back to her, yes, I want the one thing, the only thing that you can give me. I want what will strengthen our marriage bond, what will renew our covenant. I want what will be a way for us to experience our oneness. I want the one thing that will bring us together physically, spiritually, emotionally. I want to bless you. I want you to bless me. I want us together to bless our marriage. Yes, I just want that one thing. Okay. And what does she say then? It's like, oh, well, honey, if you put it that way. My point is this. It is very easy for a wife to be dismissive about sex because she does not understand what sex really means and what it really means to a man. And she may have been taught by the culture. She may have been taught even to some extent by sexual experiences that she should not have had but did before she got married to think about sex this way. But you cannot and must not allow sex to be reduced to a merely physical exchange. Okay, when you got married, you entered into a covenant on your wedding day, and now you regularly renew that covenant in the marriage bed. Sex is physical, but it's more than physical. Sex is physical, but it's also metaphysical. Sex is physical, but it's also spiritual. Sex is the experience of total oneness. And this is something that I do think husbands can help their wives understand. So, I would say, one thing, and this is something that Foster's book, It's Good to Be a Man, does, I think, a really good job with, is pointing out why God made men with such strong sex drives. Properly channeled, your sex drive is your friend, not your enemy. Okay? It's good that you want sex. That's a good thing about you. It's bad if you don't want sex with your wife. I mean, that means something has gone wrong. God wants you to have regular sex in marriage, and it's good for you to want what God wants for you to have. Okay? So sex in marriage is good. It's holy. It's strengthening. It's good for the marriage. It's good for the husband. It's good for the wife. Okay? And I think explaining that, and helping a wife understand what sex really means. That I'm not just looking for a physical release. I'm looking for that experience of total oneness with you. I think can help. Okay, I think there's a lot of things men can do to help. One other angle on this, if you guys don't mind, I'll talk about this for a few more minutes because this was something that I thought about talking about. I was actually thinking about talking about it last night and I kind of ran out of time. And then I thought about talking about it again this afternoon. But so I'll just do it right now, kind of give you the abbreviated version. It's very important to understand that sex is an obligation in marriage. Okay, now men don't have a problem with that. Okay, most husbands are like, yep, preach it, amen, brother. Okay. This can be hard for women to hear because you're saying, I have a duty, I have an obligation to have sex. Okay, that is very contrary to the way women are taught to think about even that word consent today. Now, thinking about sex as a duty in marriage is not the main way we're supposed to think about sex. Okay? It's not the main way we're supposed to think about sex. Sex is to be a joy and a blessing to both husband and wife. Okay? But sex and enjoying sex and sexual freedom and sexual frequency within marriage, those are things that the Bible speaks very frankly about. I mean, think about Proverbs chapter 5. In Proverbs 5, Solomon says that a man should be satisfied with his woman, with his wife's breasts at all times. Okay? So, men, you should not allow your wife to interfere with your obedience to that command. Okay? And if she does, that is something to discuss. Okay? I mean, God says, at all times.
Can you give that reference again?
Proverbs 5. Yeah. Obviously it wasn't this graphic, but I was doing a Summer Sanctus thing one year, and I just alluded to the fact that somewhere in Proverbs there was a passage that talked about breasts. And I was like, all the guys are going to be in bed with a flashlight, going through their Bible trying to find that passage. The Bible talks about this stuff. The Bible is very practical about these things. Very earthy when it deals with these things. The key passage here is 1 Corinthians 7, which is really continues a flow of thought from 1 Corinthians 6. I think I actually talked about this when I was here a few years ago, but I didn't really go into a lot of depth then either. But in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul is addressing the Corinthians' sexual confusion and sexual immorality. And there was a lot of that in the Corinthian church. And he says in 1 Corinthians 7, let me just turn to it really quick. He says, because of temptation, he says, let each man have his own wife and let each woman her own husband. Okay, so because there's so much sexual immorality, he basically says, just get married. Okay, some people today might say, get a hotel room. Okay, Paul would say, get a marriage license. Okay, you want to have sex? Okay, great, get married. The answer to sexual temptation is getting married and having lots of sex with your spouse. Okay, that's how the Bible addresses this question. Later on, I think it's down in, it's in verse 9, he says, if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry. It is better to marry than burn with passion. Okay, better to marry than to burn. Okay, but what's interesting is that in this passage, he frames sex within marriage as a right. Okay, he uses legal language. He describes it as a right. It is something you have a right to as a married person. Then that doesn't mean you can take it. Certainly doesn't mean you can take it by force if it's not given to you, but you do have a right to sex within marriage. And so Paul says the husband should give the wife her conjugal rights. And the wife should give her husband his conjugal rights. And then he commands in verse 5, he says, do not deprive one another. Okay, do not deprive. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Do not deprive one another unless you both consent to it. So this would be Paul's rule for marriage, and this is important for husbands to understand. If one spouse wants sex, Paul says have sex. Okay? Otherwise, the spouse that refuses is depriving the spouse that wants. Okay? That's what Paul says here. Okay, look, the reality is, in virtually every marriage, there is a sexual drive mismatch. Okay? And most of the time, the husband wants sex more often than the wife. Women can enjoy sex just as much as men, no question, but they don't tend to want it as frequently. Okay, and this is just basic biology. I mean, if you know about hormones, this is not a surprise. This is just biology. Okay, but the way a couple deals with their mismatched sex drives is going to go a long way in determining how happy their marriage is. Paul says here, the only time to not have sex is when you both agree. Okay? You both agree. Okay? You have to both consent to not having sex. You have to both consent to abstaining for a time of prayer and fasting. You know, so you can imagine a husband saying, you know, honey, I think tonight instead of having sex, we should just pray. Okay? Is that okay with you? Because if you want to have sex, I mean, I know we should. But, you know, if we should not have sex and pray, then okay, fine. Okay. We use the word consent to say, okay, if one person doesn't consent, you don't have sex. Within marriage, what Paul says is unless both spouses consent together to not have sex, have sex, which is to say if one spouse wants sex, have sex. That's the rule. Or to put it more bluntly and more plainly, sexual refusal in marriage is a sin. Very important to understand that. Sexual refusal in marriage is a sin. Now, obviously, we can qualify that in various ways. I mean, I would say missing church is a sin. We also know that there are excused absences, okay, because of sickness or whatever. You know, you could come up with different examples where we would say, okay, yeah, I understand why you didn't make it to church on this Sunday, so it's not a sin. Okay, we could do the same thing with this. We could come up with situations like just had a baby, for example. Okay. But the point is, sexual refusal in marriage is a sin in principle because you are depriving your spouse of what is rightfully theirs and what you promised to give when you got married. Okay. And it's also interesting to me, Paul situates all of this in the context of spiritual warfare. He says, do not deprive one another except with consent. So you both agree to not have sex. So nobody's being deprived. Except with consent for a time that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again. So don't let this go on too long. Okay. Don't go without sex too long, he says. So that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Paul situates this within the context of spiritual warfare. He says if you deprive your spouse or if you try to go too long without sex, you are putting your spouse or you're putting both of yourselves in a situation where Satan can tempt you. Okay? We need to just be very frank. A sexless marriage is a very wicked thing. A marriage in which sex is being regularly refused is a very defective marriage, a marriage that is not fulfilling God's design. Marriage is a sexual relationship by definition. Okay? And in marriage, sex serves several purposes. Obviously, there's the purpose of procreation, there's the purpose of pleasure, there's the purpose of protection from temptation. There's the purpose of companionship and covenant renewal. I mean, we could go on listing the purposes. In God's design, of course, marriage, sex, and children are all a package deal. Okay? We should not separate what God has joined together. But we have to reckon with this fact that sexual refusal in marriage is a sin. Now, that raises the question for a lot of husbands, and this ties in with a lot of questions that have been asked already, What do I do if my wife is regularly refusing sex? I initiate sex, she puts me off. What do I do? Okay. One thing you should not do is beat your wife over the head with 1 Corinthians 7. Okay. I mean, she needs to know about these verses, and this ties in with teaching her. Okay, you might need to teach her something about this, but you shouldn't weaponize it. Okay, you don't sling the Bible at her and say, "But the Bible says." Okay. One thing you should ask yourself is hard questions about attraction. Are there things I can do to increase my attractiveness to my wife? Okay. So that I'm not the man she has to have sex with, but the man she wants to have sex with. That's part of it. But I think the most important thing to do is this. This is what I've dealt with a handful of marriages where this was an issue over the years. And it was always the wife that was refusing sex. It's interesting. There was actually there was a case in Puritan New England, like in the 17th century, where a man was actually excommunicated for refusing to have sex with his wife. Okay? I don't know how ugly she was, but... it's just hard. It's hard to bet. But it happened. We got a record of it. That's usually not the way this plays out. It's usually the wife that refuses sex, obviously. Okay. What should a man do in this situation? Okay. And this can especially happen. Sometimes a wife will withhold sex because she wants to manipulate her husband and get her way. I think one of the reasons this passage is in the Bible is because if it wasn't, a wife could withhold sex in order to overturn God's order for marriage. Because if she withheld sex for long enough, he would eventually give in and give her her way. And then who's the head of the marriage? Okay. So you have to have a passage like this in the Bible, I think, in order to preserve the structure that God has built into marriage. Okay. A wife cannot weaponize sexual refusal as a way of manipulating her husband. You know, she can't withhold sex in order to punish her husband. But this is what I've said. And I didn't have this response the first time I encountered this, you know, many years ago as a pastor. But over the years of thinking about this and dealing with this issue, this is what I've come to. Okay. Your goal as a husband in dealing with this issue, in confronting your wife's sexual refusal, is not just to get her to have sex with you. Okay? It's not just trying to get sex for yourself. It is trying to lead your wife in repentance so she can get God's blessing. Okay? That's really what it's about. And that's why I stress, you know, a wife obeying her husband is not just for his sake, it's for her sake. Okay? I mean, that's why in 1 Peter 3 it says, you know, they trusted God and submitted to their husbands. Okay? You trust God, which means you trust God's design, and God tells you to submit to this fallible man. Okay? Same kind of thing here. It's not just trying to get sex for yourself, confronting your wife over her sexual refusal. It's that you want your wife to walk in obedience to the Lord. Okay? You want your wife to be repentant and to live in the circle of God's blessing. And so the way a man should approach it is the same way, in a sense, that he would approach his wife about any other sin. He would gently correct her, humbly teach her. He would let the word do the convicting, and he would pray. He should pray that God would soften her heart to receive his truth. Okay, that's what I think you do in that situation. Now, I'd say if it goes on long enough, I would say eventually it might be the kind of thing that you get the elders involved in the sense that I think that, I mean, we got that case of excommunication that I mentioned from Puritan New England where the man was excommunicated. But at some point, sexual refusal does become a form of covenant breaking and abandonment. You know, so those are things to think about, too. But I would say there are a lot of steps before you get to that point. So if you're not able to bring her to repentance by your ministry to her, I think this is the kind of thing that you would escalate up to the church leadership. Okay, other questions, thoughts, comments? I've given you a whole new set of... I just opened a whole new can of worms.
Not related to that. I guess it could relate to that topic. But I guess generally in a case where you're trying to like provide correction or instruction to your wife, what is the godly response for the man when she refuses to obey? And to maybe give a particular type of scenario, maybe you failed at outside influences, and when she refuses to obey, she's citing those influences, and you're now trying to...
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think husbands ought to be persistent. I don't think it's the kind of thing where you just try to correct your wife one time and she didn't do it, so, you know, now what? I would say a couple things you should not do. One is never resort to anything physical. because that's, while the husband has authority over his wife, I don't think he's authorized to exert that kind of authority. There's, you know, we have a rod for children, not for wives. So I don't think there, there's anything along those lines. I do think a husband should be persistent in his, seeking to bring correction to his wife and lead her to repentance. And I would say that after repeated attempts, he fails. I would say, you know, the good news for you is that you're in a good church. And I would say at some point you get your pastor and your elders involved. The problem with that is that in a lot of churches, they will not back up a man's headship in any kind of way. If you're in a good church, a faithful church, a really biblical church, they will. You know, they will be even-handed in how they apply the scriptures to the problem at hand. And they may find something on the husband's part he needs to repent of, if he's had a blind spot, but they will also deal with the wife's sins. We have lived in a context for so long now where women have not been confronted about their sins. And thankfully, I think that's starting to change. I talked about women's sins last night, and I don't think a single person walked out in the middle of it. You know, that's a wonderful thing. But women have been coddled by the church for so long. And I do think that is changing, but I think it's something that for many women is still really hard to deal with. I mean, it's just, you see these surveys and it's like, you know, everybody knows what men's big sins are. You know, it's lust and pornography and pride and arrogance and anger that leads to violence. I mean, the sins of men are obvious, and men know that about themselves. But when you talk to women about their sins, a lot of times it's like, well, I just don't love myself enough. I mean, it's that kind of garbage. And because women have been coddled by the church for so long, nobody has told women about their sins. And yes, women do sin too. And the Bible speaks very frankly to women about their sins, about sins of nagging and sexual refusal and disrespecting husbands and gossiping. And I mean, all these, like, there's a whole long list of very typical, you could say sort of proverbial, stereotypical female sins that the Bible addresses, and the church needs to do that. So I think that's sometimes part of the problem, is that women are just not used to having their sin confronted and exposed. But I would say that if you have been dealing with this issue for a while and you're not making any progress, you take it to your church leadership and you get them involved as counselors and mediators in the situation. It's always a big step to get an outside party involved in a marriage issue. Very big step. And that's why I generally say as much as possible, couples should try to deal with their problems in-house. But you also don't want things to go too far and get too far gone before you bring in outside help. So I would say if this is something you've been dealing with regularly, repeatedly, I would say you bring in the heavy hitters, you know, your pastor, your elders, and get them involved in the situation to act as mediators and judges in the dispute. And thankfully, you're in a church that understands and honors God's design for the family, patriarchy, the husband's headship, and that is willing to recognize that women sin. Okay, because in a lot of churches, you don't get that. Even a lot of conservative churches. Yeah, go ahead.
Is that last part you said is actually helpful. Could you maybe just talk for a minute about, like, let's say there is some issue. Is there, like, an order of, like, okay, we go to the boys at church? And then, like, does it become a, hey, we got to bring it to the elders type of level? Because I personally have some cases where my wife just wanted instantly to go to the elders and almost weaponize it.
Yeah.
And I've done the same thing.
Yeah.
So that would be helpful to have more clarification on, like, what's the proper channel?
Well, there's not a hard and fast rule for that unless Garrett wants to give you one. unless your pastor wants to... Yeah, but I would say when you have reached an impasse and it's becoming destructive of your marriage and your family life, and that's a judgment call. I mean, I don't think we have there's not like a line, that the Bible says if you cross this line, go to the elders. You know, the third time she disobeys you, call the pastor. We don't have anything like that. So I would say it's going to be a judgment call. And so that's what you have to do, is really just make a judgment as far as when to take that step. But if you reached a real impasse and it looks like there's just no way forward, and you know, I would say then that's where you take that turn.
Matthew 18 makes sense too, actually.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Matthew 18 does outline the church discipline process. So when somebody and look, I mean, a wife refusing to submit to her husband is in sin. I mean, and obviously the culture won't recognize that. Much of the church won't recognize that. But that's what the Bible says. So a wife who is not submitting to her husband is in sin. So that does have to be dealt with. It does have to be addressed. Okay, we got a few questions back here.
So I think recently Michael also proposed about the phases of going through obsession with girls and then goal and then glory. Kind of just speaking for myself, I think you can speak on all three. But if you're in that middle phase where you're like, hey, I just need to push harder at work, so make some more money, we'll relax and get a vacation. You kind of considering all the things that you're like, hey, am I stressing my life out? What's going on? Where am I in this phase? How much is enough? How do you not clamp down on your life and be like, we need to control our spending, but only one of us is making money here, and we have four kids to raise, and these are the educational choices we're making and the lifestyle choices.
Yeah.
And then you just have to take a vision and like, drive it back. How do you do that?
Yeah. Well, I didn't see that Michael Foster post, so I can't speak to that. But yeah, I would say, as a husband, you often have to make hard decisions. And a lot of those decisions, you need to hug your wife and tell her you love her and then say, and this is what we're going to have to do. And I know it's going to be hard. And that's just a reality. And that's true about money. That could be true about, I've seen this play out in different ways where husbands have had to really, work with their wives to get their wives to stick to a budget. And I even saw one situation where a husband took his wife to an older lady in church. This is a Titus 2 kind of thing. Older women teaching younger women. And he said, will you teach my wife how to manage our finances when it comes to shopping? And she did, and it was a big blessing to them. Or this is what we're going to do with education. We're committed to Christian education. We can't afford the Christian school, so as your husband, I'm asking you to homeschool our children. That's what we're going to do, and that may be hard because that may not be what she wanted. But life is hard. I mean, that's just something we have to, life is hard and it's supposed to be hard. That's just a reality. So the idea that life's going to be easy all the time is just a false dream. So I don't know if that answers your question very much, but those are the kind of things I think about. Jordan?
Can you speak, I know we've gone long, but share a few thoughts for young men as they're thinking about pursuing a spouse in today's day and age, and that's a massive topic, and then also fathers raising their daughters.
Yeah.
To be prepared for that after-parenting.
Yeah. Yeah, so young men, I would just say good luck. As John Calvin would say, good luck. It's a different world out there. I'm Gen X, and I've said before, I feel like we caught the last chopper out of Nam, kind of thing. I mean, it's like the last kind of somewhat normal generation in terms of how men and women related. I mean, the sexual revolution was already bearing really bad fruit, but at least everybody knew what bathroom to use. I mean, things were still, there was a lot of sexual sinning going on, but things were still reasonably sane. Today's dating situation is very, very difficult. So this is what I would say to young men. I would say, don't be discouraged. There are fine young Christian women out there. I would say be picky, but not too picky. Okay, recognize, obviously physical attraction is a non-negotiable. You have to be physically attracted to this woman or you won't have any interest, period. Okay, so that has to be there. But, if a woman doesn't completely align with every single one of your convictions theologically, I would say that may be something you can work with. I mean, is she teachable? Is she submissive to the scripture? I'd say in today's, especially, our circle in the Series C, we're pretty small, we're pretty niche. If you go fishing in this pond and you don't find anybody, you might have to go fish in another pond where there's slightly different theological convictions about some things, but you could still catch a pretty good fish there. Women love those kind of analogies, by the way. Here's one thing I would tell young men, never take dating advice from a woman. Okay. The prey does not teach the hunter how to catch it. I would tell you to network as much as possible. I don't like dating apps for all kinds of reasons, but I would tell you to tap into your network as much as possible. If it's not already known, let people know that you're looking for someone. that you'd like to get married and you know, see if there's anybody that's somebody in your network of family and friends, you know, there's somebody they might know that, you know, that would be a good match for you. I would say work on yourself so that when she comes along, you really can catch her, so that you've made yourself the most attractive version of yourself, like you've got a mission, you're going somewhere. In Genesis 2, I always point this out, it is mission before marriage. Adam is given a job before he's given a wife. So you'll have much better success if you're already on a track to something meaningful, if you have your mission in life sorted out. Doesn't mean you can't, you know, change careers or whatnot down the line, but you know, if you want to get married young, you're asking a woman to marry your potential that hasn't been fully actualized, but you should at least be demonstrating some of that potential. That you will be a good protector and provider and a man who is worthy of the patriarchal role, headship. So those are things I would do. I don't think there's any secret formula or, you know, magic wand you can wave that, you know, that makes that, you know, gorgeous girl that wants to marry you appear. You just have to work at seeking her out. And I know it is, it's rough out there, much more difficult than it used to be. For raising daughters, I would say the biggest influence, daughters are influenced in two key ways when it comes to how they will be as future wives. They're influenced by their father. So if they have a father they love and respect, that sort of sets the bar for what they expect in a man they will marry. And that's really important. So if she's got a bad father, you know, she's going to be seeking male attention probably in all kinds of really bad ways. If she's got a good father, that helps. That sets the bar high for what she expects. And she doesn't go pursuing that kind of male attention in ways that will get her into trouble. But her mother has a huge influence in terms of how she understands what it means to be a wife, what it means to understand her understanding of what it means to be a mother. And so a wife who is disrespectful, who speaks disrespectfully, or who rolls her eyes at her husband is teaching her daughter that men are not really worthy of respect. And that woman might get married, and then she's going to bring that into the marriage with her and think, oh, you know, men are not really worthy of respect, okay? And, you know, masculinity is just sort of one big joke, okay? And there's a lot of women like that out there today. So when you're raising your daughters, one of the most important things is to make sure that your wife is openly respectful towards you so that your daughters get to see that, so that your daughters get to see what it looks like to have a functioning, healthy marriage that's full of love and respect. Okay, so she actually gets to see that lived out in the home. I think that's probably the most important thing. But I would also say there's a lot of things you need to do for your daughter in terms of guarding her, protecting her, obviously. What I did with my girls, I don't think it's not like there's one recipe or one formula, but I told my girls, you know, basically none of my kids dated in high school. They could go on a date as an event, but we were not going to do the boyfriend-girlfriend thing when, you know, they're 16 years old because marriage is still so far off. I wanted dating, you know, any kind of serious relationship to be with a view to marriage. And when marriage is still a long way off, it doesn't make sense to start that. So that was the rule we had for our kids. So they could go with a date to an event, but we weren't going to do the boyfriend-girlfriend thing. But then, you know, when my daughters went to college, I said, you know, if you get asked out on a date, I trust you to make the initial judgment to say yes or no. Obviously, you know, he's got to be a Christian. He's got to be a like-minded believer. He's got to be a man you trust and respect. But if he passes your test for a first date, you can say yes to that. But I said, if it's going to be a second, third date, that's where you start to pull dad in and get dad's opinion of this guy. Okay, so I trust you to make an initial judgment, but you know, I'd say, sweetie, I know a lot more about, you know, 20-year-old men than you do. So you need my expert opinion. And that worked, you know. I mean, all three of my, well, my youngest is engaged, but she'll be married in May. So all three of my daughters have married good men. That worked well. And I think that was a good approach. I think you know, your mileage may vary. You may have to make some adjustments as a father with your daughters, depending on their situation, whether they live at home or they're off at college. You know, it's just different situations there. But raise your daughters in such a way that they can make decisions, that you do trust them. Okay. I think there are some men who have this idea, you know, dads who have this idea that courtship means that, you know, I vet every candidate before they've even spoken to each other. basically, or before they have any kind of contact with each other, and I meet him at the door with a shotgun. And I told my daughters, I said, I will never drive a good man away. I will never drive a good man away. I want you to get married. Like, we're on the same page, you know, so I want you to get married. I'm not going to drive a good man away. You know, if you bring a man to meet us, I'm going to give him every chance in the world to impress us. Okay, and if he's not a good man, obviously I'm going to say no. I want to protect you from that, but I'm going to do everything I can to work with you on this.
Yeah, also the leadership you show at home with your family, it also determines what kind of man she ultimately wants to look for or thinks is a good man. Because if you can be a great dad, and she, you know, lead in those following ways to her. In all the perfect ways. If you're not meeting them and making those decisions, she's going to look for a man that may be great to her, but it's not a leader.
Right.
And so now we're kind of stuck in that cycle. She's having to man up.
Yeah. I think there are actually some women who want to marry a weak man because they want to marry a man they can control. They think that will make them happy, and they find out too late that was a bad decision. Okay, just like a lot of women think that career is going to make them happy and they'll go right back to work after they have a baby, and so they don't mind the $200,000 in college debt they piled up, and then they hold that baby in their arms and like, oh wait, I just made a huge mistake. My whole life has been a mistake. Okay, same kind of thing. I mean, some women will marry men that they think they can control because they think that will make their life easier or happier, and it doesn't. So that is definitely something you got to drive home with your wife. I mean, you may be familiar with the term hypergamy. Okay, hypergamy is the built-in desire that women have to marry up. Okay? And what I mean by up is a woman wants to marry a man who generally is taller, bigger, stronger, faster, more accomplished, more educated, more experienced in the world, earns more money. She wants to marry up. Okay? Now, some men are like, oh, this hypergamy thing is such a problem, you know. And I understand, I mean, it can be frustrating. In an egalitarian world, hypergamy makes marriage very difficult, okay? Because when you're pushing for the sexes to be equal, socially, politically, culturally, economically, and then you go over here to this, you know, to the dating market, so to speak, and you want things unequal, okay, where, you know, so the woman can marry up, that just doesn't work. Okay, I mean, it's like I've pointed this out. I don't know when I did this, if this was last time I was here or not, but I mean, I remember two different headlines in the same, they were in the same magazine or on the same website. And one of the headlines was women complaining about the wage gap that they want to earn just as much as men, which of course the whole wage gap thing is nonsense. Women do earn as much as men when they do the same work. Okay, but it was complaining about that. And then the next article from a few weeks later was complaining about how women can't find men who earn enough money to be economically attractive. So you can't say you want equal wages when you go to work and then say, but you want to date a guy who earns more money when you go to marry. Like, pick a lane. Okay? Do you want equal treatment or special treatment? You know, do you want equality or romance? I mean, you cannot have both. You just can't, okay? But feminism has sold this lie that women can have it all, and so women have bought it, and they think they can, and they can't. You just can't. It's not possible. So hypergamy means that women want to marry up. I would say it's a design feature, and in some ways, it's a design feature to bring out the best in men. Like, to get a woman, you have to make something of yourself. Here's a little, you know, I have these little red pill proverbs I use sometimes to kind of get these things across. For men, well, let me start with women. For women, nature is kind and time is cruel. For men, nature is cruel and time is kind. A woman has everything she needs to attract a man handed her by nature. Okay? Because what are men attracted to? Her natural features. Okay, in terms of the creation mandate, it's those features that demonstrate that she would be a good candidate for multiplication. Okay, let's just put it that way. Okay, so she has everything she needs given to her by nature to attract a man, but she loses it over time. Time is cruel. So a woman's got a window of time when she is at peak attractiveness. And, you know, and that's another thing I would tell you know, if you're raising daughters, that's something I would point out is, you know, honey, like, you shouldn't just marry the first guy that comes along, but you should recognize that your prime years for finding the best possible husband are going to be, like, in your early 20s, because that's when you are most attractive. And it's not that you won't be still attractive later on, but it's just you're not going to be the same level of attractiveness. Like, they do these surveys, and, you know, what age do men find most attractive? Well, it doesn't matter whether the man is 15 years old or 95 years old. He picks the 20-year-old girl as the most attractive. Okay, for women, it's different. Like, as women get older, they actually find older men more attractive. Of course, they don't find many men attractive at all, period, physically. Which that's just another hard truth about reality. So for women, nature is kind, but time is cruel. For men, it's the other way around. Nature is cruel. Nature did not give you anything you need to be attracted to a woman. You have to go make something of yourself. You have to go build something. You have to go build a life that then you can invite a woman into, the kind of life she'd want to be a part of. Okay. Mission before marriage. You got to develop your mission. Nature doesn't give it to you. You got to build it. Okay. And that's why time is kind for men, because over time you can build, you know, men can get more attractive over time. I mean, men too will eventually reach a point of diminishing returns, but you get more attractive over time because you're building up more status and wealth and confidence and competencies, the kind of things that women are attracted to. Those are just they may seem like brutal realities, but they're just facts about the world, and it doesn't do any good to complain about them. If you complain about reality, you know, reality's not going to change. So you need to adjust yourself to how reality works, and that's just it. Okay, anything else?
Let's get Pastor Russell.
Okay, yep, thank you.